This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
What Obama, when he was running for office, would be asked something like, what is patriotism? And he'd say, patriotism begins with people caring about each other. The most important thing my mother taught me was empathy, to put yourself in someone else's shoes. What you want in a judge is empathy. And they confuse that with sympathy.
Remember when President Obama nominated Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court and empathy was transformed by some political commentators into a dirty word? This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk to two giants in their respective fields who think empathy is probably pretty important, especially when it comes to policy. First, we talk to Marion Nessel, a noted nutritionist and author whose latest book digs into the power of cartoons to drive home complex arguments for fighting food insecurity issues in this country. Next, progressive linguist extraordinaire George Lakoff discusses how liberals need to improve their messaging to convince people that policies that help people are actually a good idea. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Marion Nessel. She's a professor of sociology, a nutritionist, and an author of several books on nutrition. Marion, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Oh, glad to be here.
So your latest book, it's an illustrated guide to food politics called Eat, Drink, Vote. Why don't you first explain what gave you the idea and what demographic you're trying to tap into with this project?
Well, it's a cartoon book. It's a book of political cartoons, and if I must say so, really good ones. It's a partnership with a cartoon bank that represents about 50 prize-winning political cartoonists, and the project just fell into my lap, and it seemed like such a fabulous idea that when the head of the cartoon bank suggested that we do a collaboration on a book about food politics using their cartoons, I just leaped at the chance. I love cartoons. I always use them. I've got drawers full of them in my file cabinets. And the problem with using cartoons in any kind of academic work is you have to pay for them. And this was an opportunity to have 250 cartoons that I wasn't going to have to pay for because we did a collaboration and they hold the rights. So it was just too good an opportunity to pass up. And I have to say, it was more fun than anything to do because she sent me 1,100 cartoons to choose from. That was the hardest part, was figuring out which ones to use.
I was interested while I was looking through it. If you wrote some of the chapters to fit the cartoons or the other way around?
I wrote them to fit the cartoons. What I did was to take these 1,100 cartoons and, oh my goodness, I had piles of cartoons all over my apartment. And they naturally sorted out into the way I think about these kinds of issues. And then I wrote chapters around them. The biggest decision was what to do about the commentary on the cartoons. Was I going to write explanations of each of them? And I decided that would just be so boring that nobody would want to see it. And once I made the decision to let the cartoons speak for themselves, then the book just practically wrote itself. And all I had to do was to establish the context to make my opinion about the issues very clear, because I don't always agree with the cartoonists. I think they have very, very different views of some of these issues than I do. But I didn't want to have an argument with them. I wanted them to be able to speak for themselves.
Do any examples come to mind when you're thinking of the differing opinions of some of the cartoonists?
Yeah, absolutely. I, for example, am extremely sensitive about the question of obesity. And the cartoonists find it very easy to illustrate the concept of obesity with extraordinarily grotesquely fat caricatures of people. And I would have preferred that they not do that. But it's much easier for them to use that as a a way of talking about obesity rather than talking about all the environmental causes of the problem and the political causes of the problem that I do. So that would be one. Another would be the Bloomberg administration's attempt to set a 16-ounce cap on sodas, which the cartoonists in this group routinely ridiculed and thought was the most ridiculous thing they'd ever seen. And I actually thought it was a pretty good idea. And well worth trying. So I make my opinion pretty clear in the text that accompanies the cartoons. The cartoonists speak for themselves, and readers can make up their own minds, and that's the way I like to teach anyway.
The issue of the soda cap in New York City has larger ramifications, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And these kinds of things are become very class-based very, very quickly. Because soda consumption is higher among poor people, it's very cheap, and so is obesity higher among poor people. So here are rich people telling poor people what to do, and that's complicated, as many of these things are. And even though the measure was a measure that was in the health interests of people who are most vulnerable, to overweight and its consequences, it doesn't mean that people necessarily like it. The other problem is that you can't really divorce these kinds of activities from the marketing efforts of soda companies, which are highly targeted to low-income communities.
I think that's really the key, is that on one hand, that there's wealthy and powerful people who are trying to affect change in the soda cap example, or trying to have some kind of policy that will shift things to healthier choices for people who are in less privileged positions. But the wealthy and powerful corporations have been for decades trying to change the way we eat and drink, haven't they?
Yes, and they've done it very successfully. I mean, they have, for example, made drinking sodas all day long to be a completely normal part of daily food intake. It didn't used to be, and it certainly didn't used to be in the quantities that people or in the sizes that people are drinking now. And we know from all of the research that's been done that people will drink more soda from larger size soda bottles. I mean, it really is that simple. And in a sense, the soda industry, just out of normal business interests, has created a situation in which people are taking in more sugary calories than is good for them. And it's, if you want to try to do something about that, the soda industry is going to fight back, and it's going to fight back hard. And it's been doing that, and that's where the taking the city to court business has come in.
Forget your weakness and dance. Cost of living gets so high. Rich and poor, they start to cry. Now the weak must get. They say, oh, what a tribulation. Them belly full, but we hungry. Hungry mob is a hungry mob. A rain a fall, but the dirt it tough. A pot of yoke, but you not enough. We're gonna chuck to jam music. Chucking, hey. We're chucking to jam music. We're chucking.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Marion Nessel. She's a professor of nutrition at New York University, and she is an author of several books on nutrition. Can you catch us up on the recent news about the House of Representatives trying to slash more food stamps from the budget?
Yeah, it's hard to know what to make of it. What the House has done is to pass a bill that removes $4 billion a year from the food stamp SNAP program for the next 10 years, an enormous, enormous cut that is going to affect millions of people. And it's hard to imagine that Congress would do this in a situation where the job situation is bad and many people are out of work and are hardly making it and are having such a hard time getting by, and food stamps are the difference between them going hungry and maybe being able to feed their families. So there's a cruelty in there that is hard to fathom. But the political aspect of it I understand very well. They just want Obama out of office. And they will do anything, including sacrificing millions of Americans in order to get that.
Yeah, and it's a strange political gambit for sure. I don't see how looking like the ruthless party who doesn't care about poor people is good politics, but that's another matter. Could you also explain the link with the farm bill and the unlinking of it?
Well, up until now, actually still until now, food stamps are part of the farm bill. That's a long story in itself. But 80% of the cost of the farm bill is food stamps because so many people are out of work and so many people qualify. And so the House sees this as a way to cut budget. And they passed their version of the farm bill with the food stamps removed. And the farm bill that they passed has an enormous amount, billions of dollars in corporate welfare for large agribusiness firms. And so it's okay to do corporate welfare. It's not okay to do welfare for the poor. And they separated it out. Now, the Senate bill has them still connected and has food stamps with a much smaller cut. And now these bills have to be reconciled, and they're so far apart. The House and the Senate are so far apart on this that it's impossible to imagine how they can come to any kind of compromise. The point of compromise is not visible anywhere. The president has said that he will not sign a bill that reflects what the House has done. And the Senate is holding firm on its position, and I think the House is going to bring down the government and run the budget out so that we don't have a budget at the end of October because they can't come to compromise. So it's very unusual in American history for the parties not to understand that they must find some point of compromise in order to keep the government going. But it looks to me like the House just wants to bring the government down. And they've said that that's their goal, that their purpose is to end Obamacare and not have a health care system, even though the majority of the population really would like to have some kind of health care system.
There was also, I think it was 2010, when school lunch, the free and reduced lunch program, was slated to be linked to the food stamp cut from 2013. Is that correct?
Yeah, they needed money to fund the new school food standards, and they took it out of food stamps, but it was taken out of food stamps in a way that was not meant to have a permanent effect. But now the whole thing is up for grabs at this point, so it's very, very hard to know how it's going to play out. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't figure it out.
It seems like the Republican messaging on this issue has been to try to, besides the overarching theme, which you mentioned, which is just to be anti-Obama and to overthrow Obamacare, has been to poke at food policy. And there's a Vitter Amendment, for example, in the Farm Bill that said no food stamp eligibility if you're a convicted pedophile.
Student.
A student?
Yeah, I mean, they're taking students out, they want work requirements, and they want all kinds of things.
If you fail drug tests, and I was talking to a right-wing friend of mine who shall remain nameless and saying, well, do you think that somebody should be, you know, smoking pot at home and being able to eat for free on the government dime? That's kind of the caricature that they want to create.
Yeah, a lot of these kinds of things are satirizable and would be hilarious if people's lives weren't at stake. And the cartoonists just dig right in and get right to the heart of the hypocrisy of some of the politicians that we have these days, who are enormously hypocritical. They're happy to take farm subsidies but not vote for food stamps. They're happy to take whatever the government is giving away that does them good, but they get very self-righteous when we're talking about poor people who don't have any resources, and all of the pressure. I mean, and these kinds of attitudes about the poor date back to the English poor laws of the 15th century. I mean, it isn't as if this is new. The purpose of welfare always was to make sure the poor didn't get too much, and that and the idea is always that you're just frantic about fraud. The Department of Agriculture spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year on fraud prevention in the food stamp program, and you would think that some of that money would really help people survive, but that's not the way a lot of our congressional representatives, most of whom are exceedingly rich, see it. And so, you know, if we're going to change the system, we've got to change the electoral system. I see that as the basis of corruption in American government, is the amount of money that's involved in that. And if the cartoonists help point these things out, which I think they do, then I'm happy to promote the work of cartoonists, which is what this book is about.
She's the best-selling author of What to Eat, and her latest book is Eat, Drink, Vote, Marion Nestle. Marion, it's been an honor to have you on Sea Change Radio. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure.
You just call on me, brother, when you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem. We all need somebody to lean on me. When you're not strong, and I'll be your friend, I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm gone.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
Next, I'm joined on Sea Change Radio by UC Berkeley linguistics professor George Lakoff. George, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
A pleasure to be here.
Now, many of us have heard about how the right wing of this country has co-opted the word freedom and made liberal a dirty word. That's also kind of happened with the word empathy, hasn't it?
There's an attack on empathy. I don't know if you've been following it. It started
with Kagan or Sotomayor when she
Sotomayor.
Was... Sotomayor. Yeah, and she was empathetic. This was a terrible buzzword, apparently, right?
Right. See, what Obama, when he was running for office, would be asked something like, what is patriotism? And he'd say, patriotism begins with people caring about each other. The most important thing my mother taught me was empathy, to put yourself in someone else's shoes. What you want in a judge is empathy. And they confuse that with sympathy, because conservatives don't naturally have empathy. They don't naturally function morally in terms of empathy. Sympathy says, this person is like me, I'm gonna go with them.
I would think the term bleeding heart liberal kind of
yes.
summarizes what you're talking about, that difference between sympathy and empathy, because sympathy is a bleeding heart. Right. Somebody who's, poor Bob had lost his
right.
job. But like, but somebody who's empathetic can put themselves in Bob who lost his job's shoes.
Right. And there's many forms of empathy. Empathy studies began very seriously through an interesting discovery in Italy in early 1990s, in Parma. And I've worked with the people in that lab. And what happened was, they first discovered it with monkeys. They were working with monkeys, and they were looking at the premotor cortex, which choreographs actions. and they had probes in the monkeys' brains to see which neurons were firing when they would push buttons or peel bananas or crack peanuts or, you know, grab bars or something like that, or pick up an object and put it down. They were trained to do these things, and you could see what neurons were firing. And they were doing that fine. They had a computer checking on all the neurons that were firing. And one day, the grad student who was running this, who I happen to know now, went out to lunch. It's Italy, you have a nice lunch. Come back, and oh, no dessert. There's a pile of bananas. You pick up a banana, you start to eat it, and you hear the computer go click, 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 click. You know, and you say, wait, that's connected to the monkey, not me. They go and check what neurons are firing. It's the banana peeling neurons. They discover that we have neurons in our head that fire when we either perform an action or we see someone performing the same action. That's not just the neurons. It's actually the system of circuitry, and that circuitry has been shown to link motor part of the brain to the vision part of the brain, to the judgment part of the brain, to the emotional part of the brain, which enables you to see someone else, and you can tell if they're suffering or happy and so on by looking at their body, because there is a physiology of emotions. So if you can see what their body is doing, you know how your body is doing. That's linked to the emotional regions, and you can tell if they're, you know, what they're feeling. Now, if you do that, that is the basis of empathy, but there are many forms. So the first form is, can you do that? Do you know what they're feeling? But then there is a question of, do you feel what they're feeling? Because feeling is not just registering in the brain, in the insula and the amygdala, what someone else is feeling. The insula and the amygdala are connected to the viscera, to your heart, your lungs, your liver, your organs, and to your whole body. So the question is, do you feel it in your body? That is the strongest form of empathy. When you see somebody there and you feel what's going on in them in your body. And that can be done with television too. You know, people are, you know, with the Boston Marathon or the floods, they feel it in their bodies. Now, that's the first part. That's the strongest form of empathy. But there's another form where you don't feel it in your body, because in the frontal part of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, there have been neurons discovered that are connected to the other neurons that fire more when you do it and less when the other guy does it. And there's a reason for that. The mirror neurons that fire, you know, when you're both seeing and doing something, actually fire more when you're doing it and less when the other guy's doing it. And so the judgment part of your brain can tell you when to shut off empathy, when it's not appropriate and when it's not appropriate, when it's appropriate to feel and when it's not appropriate to feel but to understand. Right? So there is that. The other part to understand has to do with vision. So you can see someone else, but it turns out the same part of the brain is there for imagination as for vision, is used in the same way. So you can imagine people, you can read a book and feel empathy for a character. And that's using imagination. You can see a movie and feel empathy for a character. It doesn't have to be real. Can be in your imagination. And you can hear about, you know, this factory collapses in Bangladesh and, hundreds of women are crushed to death in that, and you can feel empathy there, and it may be in your body and it may not. You may feel what it is like to feel crushed by a building, or you may just know what it's like. Those are two different forms of empathy. One is feeling it and the other is knowing it. But either one is important for progressive thought, because progressive thought says we feel empathy for at least our fellow citizens, and that's why we provide all these public provisions to the government. And what conservatives want to do is say that's immoral. We should not be providing anything for anybody. We should do it for ourselves. Now, when you actually look at this, actually, you can't do it for yourselves. No conservative ever does. You know, if you look at the Republican National Convention, when they had this "we made it" idea, you know, yes, I did this business all by myself. You know, I went to college and I took these courses. Well, how did you go to college and who set up
right.
the college?
Elizabeth Warren had a pretty powerful, that was like at a fundraiser, where it was used against her by her conservative opponent, Scott Brown, but it was actually, it summarized quite well that you didn't build this. There was a lot of work for her the last couple hundred years to create this environment where you can be an entrepreneur.
Right. Elizabeth Warren has done it better than any other political leader. She is fantastic at it.
I'd be curious your reaction to when the Obama administration decided to embrace the term Obamacare. Was that a tipping point where they decided to go on offense and we should just embrace this thing? Because the term Obamacare kind of encapsulates a lot of what you're talking about in that empathetic term. And it depends if you like the president or not, whether or not you, whether that hits home or not for you, that Obamacare term. But it was used against him. And then they were like, you know what? We're going to run with this.
Well, they had to, and it's unfortunate because it was a bad idea in general to do. It's generally a bad idea to do that. And
to do what?
To say, to take the conservative term and use it. But in this case, they could have done this. Now, it's important to understand why the country went against the president's health care plan. Okay, here's why. When Obama got elected, even before he took office, he asked his pollster, who I talked to during that period, and he asked the pollster to go and see what proposals, what ideas should go into the health care plan, what people most liked and cared about. And he came back and he said, well, you know, no preconditions and putting your kid on your insurance during college, you know, all those things, no caps on, you know, cancer, you know, universal act, you know, everybody should be able to have it, you know, et cetera. There's a big list, and it was the right list, right? And not only, you know, that at the time, Jacob Hacker had proposed the idea of a government competition, you know, with private health care. That could have been turned into, step by step, into Medicare for All. And Hacker had worked out how you would do this and so on, and it fit those things. So what the pollster found out was that between 60 and 80% of the people were in favor of each of the provisions. And that's still true today. It never wavered. You know, you ask, you know, what about preconditions? Everybody says there shouldn't be any preconditions, right? No problem. And they thought that if everybody was in favor of all of the parts of the health care, that they would be in favor of the whole plan. The Republicans knew better. They went, because if you think about it, what part of the brain is used for those provisions? It's when you're sick and you need health care and you're going into the health care system. The Republicans went moral. And they said, there are two moral principles at stake here. One is freedom and the other is life. It's government takeover and death panels. Government takeover and death panels repeated over and over again until the biconceptuals, the people who are partly conservative and partly progressive, moved over and took on, you know, that activated their conservative worldview.
You knew the Republicans had won that debate when you started seeing signs like, government stay out of my Medicare.
Exactly. The Democrats laughed and said, oh, these people are ignorant. No, the Democrats were ignorant because they didn't know how a brain worked. And that's the point. Democrats are great on policy, and they're not great on how brains work. Republicans are better on how brains work because they have people who've studied marketing, and the people in marketing know how brains work.
George Lakoff, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Robert Walter, Bob Marley and the Wailers, and Bill Withers.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.